Welcome to Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program making space for the voices of gender diverse people. Produced at 3CR Community Radio in NAM, Melbourne, and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. I'm your host, Kanagi. Women on the Line acknowledges that this program is produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and their sovereignty was never ceded. We acknowledge their elders past and present, as well as the owners of the land on which you're hearing this from. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Sharvari is a theatre historian from India, currently teaching at the University of Chicago. Her research looks at the complex links between live performance and recorded history in South Asia, and traces how gender, sexuality, and caste-based essentializations are articulated and historicized through performance. Her first book, Performances of Posterity, Theatre Archives and Cultural Regulation in Modern India, looks into processes of cultural preservation and appropriation in performance and tracks how these forms came to be denigrated, censored, reformed, reclaimed, and reinvented in accordance with prevailing political and social aspirations. On this episode of Women on the Line, Sharvari joins us to talk about her upcoming book, The Historical Erasure of Caste and Gender in Theatre, The Impermanence of Researching Performance, The Linguistic Complexities of Indian Theatre, and The Changing Nature of Resistance and Oppression Through Art.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. So my name is Sharvari, and I teach at the University of Chicago currently and in the Department of Theatre and Performance Studies. So I'm broadly a theatre historian of South Asian theatre, mostly Indian, and I also freelance as a dramaturg. So I'm kind of half academic, half practice, and that's how I occupy my time.
Amazing. You are doing a really interesting PhD. Tell us about what it is, tell us about the topic and how you got interested in it.
I will just say that I've actually finished my PhD. So this was my PhD, which I'm currently in the process of converting into a book. So my PhD was on thinking around the relationship between archives and performance in modern India. And broadly, I was really excited by noticing that in the modern kind of period post-independence, a theater began to be used as a kind of archival site to say, okay, if there is other forms, like especially folk forms that are, you know, getting are dying. This is something people have to say, that folk forms are dying, that they're dying or they're not getting enough recognition or they're at risk in some way, that theater can be a way of kind of salvaging them and safeguarding them. And this all sounds great, right? It sounds like, how nice, let's save things. But as I looked into it, I found that it's a little bit more complicated. We need to ask questions of who has the right to save something, what is being saved, for what purpose. So how I began to frame this was I looked specifically into the history of what's often called a folk form. I have some, you know, some scare quotes around that label folk, but essentially a kind of subaltern form that's local to Western India called tamasha. And I was looking into how the preservation of this form really became a kind of theatrical problem. Like everybody in theater suddenly wanted to do this thing of, let's make plays that are about the history of tamasha. Let's make plays that save tamasha. And what I found was over the span of, you know, many years from 1947 is where I start, and then up to literally the present, 2025, people have been doing this. They're making plays, trying to salvage and intervene in tamasha in various ways. And they have specific projects that they want to achieve with this. Like, you know, as always, the right-wing nativists make their appearance. So they use it for like a kind of right-wing agenda, saying this is a form of cultural heritage. So you should take out all the fun out of it, like all the eroticism, all the kind of ribaldry, the double entendre, let's take that out. Let's also take out the women sometimes, because that's convenient. And very crucially, they also changed the caste composition. It used to be that tamasha is a form that is performed by caste oppressed people, so which in the Indian context, you would call them Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi, DBA is what we say. But then as the right wing takes over, as they do all over the world, they tend to like insert themselves. So that's one part of the story. But then it also gets taken up by anti-caste activists. It also gets taken up by feminists. It's also get taken up now increasingly by queer activists who are like, this is great. There's impersonation in it and there's sensuality in it. So can we just think of this as a queer art form? So there's a way in which, you can enter into this history through different kind of doors almost. And I was interested in like, how do we see all of those doors at once?
Yeah, that's so interesting. For listeners in Australia who might not be across what tamasha means linguistically,
Mm-hmm.
could you give a little background on that? Because I feel it really gives context to what the art form is.
Totally. So, when you use it in like everyday parlance, you'd say, stop doing a tamasha, like what a tamasha you've put up, which really kind of translates to a spectacle, essentially. And this can be used pejoratively, mostly, right, to be like, this is just a song and a dance with no content. Like it's superficial. That's usually how it's deployed. But it could also just mean something that's really fun and kind of, an upside down world. So colloquially, tamasha really means this kind of spectacle. Though it also designates the specific form that is kind of like a cabaret-like form almost. It has many different parts, including a skit, a dance sequence, some repartee with the audience, an invocation of a god. So it has many different components. So that's what's really interesting, right? Like, so the question that I have and a lot of other people have is the designation for the form, did that precede this colloquial use of it as spectacle, or was it the other way around? No one knows. But the point is that everyone looks down upon tamasha, and that's regulated in language, reflected in the language.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my next question. Are they linked? So that's interesting that nobody knows that.
Yeah.
But it makes sense that, something that was looked down on is somehow linked to all these marginalized groups trying to use it in a positive way.
Yeah, totally. And it's also not clear, there's a way in which when you talk about kind of popular performances, what they are called is not necessarily a reflection of how deep the history is. It's very possible that it existed under a different name. So that whether what came first is a hard thing to pin down. Yes, totally, you're right that the fact of it being something performed by marginalized folks is very much the way in which its kind of pejorative use gets invoked, right? And that's something I was also really interested in tracking is there's a way in which all these, the fact that it is actually dehumanizing, that gets, you can so easily fade that into the background. Say like, everyone knows that tamasha is something that has no content, right? And then you actually look into it and you say, what kind of assumptions around caste, gender, sexuality have to go in for you to make a statement like that? So uncovering these kinds of complexities, which honestly sometimes it gets so much into the weeds that it's hard to swim out, but that's part of the pleasure of this kind of work, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, it is really complex. What have you unearthed that, I mean, I'm sure a lot, but is there anything that really stands out to you?
Well, a bunch. One is, I think one thing that gives me hope, and this may sound very abstract, but one thing that gives me hope is, so much of my work was tracking how much has been done to hegemonically like and dominate this form, right? To like bury it under censorship, under regulation, under appropriation. How much has been done? Yet, beyond the point, like all empires fall, all acts of domination are resisted. There are ways of looking for like spaces of relief, of protest. And so I think that's what has been the biggest takeaway for me at the broadest level is that when you work with forms like that are alive, like performance, you can, on the one hand, find histories of oppression, but you can also find histories of resistance. And that has been to me the most exciting thing. The most confusing thing is that these can exist all in one, right? And so, for instance, I feel like a lot of the caste-based, when I said like tamasha was used for a lot of anti-caste work, where a lot of Dalit playwrights, which are caste oppressed playwrights, were like, this is a form that is historically been used by us, so we need to find a way around it. This was a very complicated discourse because, as you might know or have heard of, there was a kind of call by Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar, who was a Dalit activist, to kind of leave behind any form of sexual servitude or any kind of servitude. And the question was, is tamasha a form of servitude? Like, do we need to leave it behind? So this became a really complex question. Like, is this something that you preserve as cultural heritage, or is it something that you leave behind as a form of servitude? So there was a real complex reckoning among Dalit activists about what do we do with this form. But in all this, what happened is a lot of the plays that I ended up looking at had no women, because they really complicated the gap, right? If you take out the women, then you're like, cool, we don't have to touch this issue at all. Because if you take out the women, you take out the issue of sexuality, sexual servitude completely out of the equation. So then it becomes really complex, right? On the one hand, these are resistant texts, but their resistance is mounted on erasing the question of like gender out of it completely. So then those are the kind of complexities that I feel like I'm still sitting with. And I think that's good. It's good not to have those questions resolved. It forces you to think about them again and again and again.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like it also raises the question of morality and what that means for women, for queer people, and for caste oppressed people. And I think particularly for the time for women, right? Like that's part of the reason they were just being removed, right? Because all of a sudden you stand on a higher moral ground.
Yeah, and also, yeah, I mean, it was complex. I think there's a lot that's been written. I think Shailaja Paik's work is, which is recent, is incredible. She's a MacArthur genius, as of last year, who really talks about that, there's a kind of respectability politics that also a lot of caste oppressed people feel like compelled to respond to, right? So like you said, a lot of the erasure of women or erasure of their experience comes from this. Like women, as we know from time, any kind of example in any kind of context, the existence of gendered and sexual minorities complicates morality, right? Like it messes up respectability politics. That's just generally what our contemporary discourse on like trans lives are, our discourse on queerness is that it's too muddy. Like it messes everything up. So I think similarly, that was always the issue. The problem is also you can't really erase them at all. So you read even texts that seem to take them out completely, you can still find traces and instances of people insisting themselves into existence, even despite what the text wants to do. And
Yeah.
that's what's fun.
I mean, of course, it's part of the human existence, right? Okay, tell me more about the caste aspect of it and how it translates to caste in India now.
Well, that's a big question. So one thing I will say is that still today, tamasha performance is still dominated by people from caste oppressed communities, and this is again it's a very complex kind of melange, because it includes, also what are called like tribes, which is nomadic tribe, which is again kind of term that means everything and nothing at the same time in some ways. But I think that I like the term caste oppressed because it kind of is an umbrella term. So that is still true. But what I will say is that the story of Tamasha, as I see it, is really kind of, in a sense, a case study for how we can really kind of disappear questions of caste under other labels of morality, respectability, history, even like these big concepts where you say, oh, because what we want to do is save history, we'll do this thing that's actually an act of like caste dominance, but will never be named as such or even approached as such, right? So, and I think that in a sense, it's kind of an analogy for so many things that happen even now. Like, why do we not want a census, right? Like things that happen all the time where the excuse the completely the rationale behind it is kind of caste-based power, but it is never ever depicted as such. So
Yeah, I think caste definitely still remains to be the most unspoken about topic in India and of course globally. It's so consistently just skated over, people don't want to go near it. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You've been looking at archival records in several languages, right? How has that impacted your project? Does the depth of language make a difference to what you're learning?
Yes, I look at archival records in primarily three for this project. I looked at Hindi, Marathi, and English mostly. I mean, it's interesting. One of the just anecdotally, I'm not a Marathi speaker. This is a language that I vaguely knew, but kind of learned for this project. And now I've developed a register on it where I can understand the official, because I spent so much time with official records. I understand it so well, but my colloquial speaking is still so poor because I just encounter it at this level of language. So I think speaking in different languages, what's also interesting in working across different languages is how terms from one migrate to the other and how do they mean very different things. Within specific kind of linguistic contexts. Like for instance, the word tamasha is very much used in English kind of newspaper articles to be like, oh, we went to a cricket match and it was a big tamasha. Like that is a word that has very much in the Indian English lexicon travel, like kind of traveled. But what also is interesting about working across a range of languages is unfortunately, it makes you have to do much more specific work because you realize how much, I think, in a way that you don't in everyday life, how much things mean so specifically in languages that don't even like it doesn't even translate to like the level of India. You really have to work within Hindi, this is what this word means, or this is what this idea means, is how this text would circulate. The other thing would be that things get translated, and it's very interesting to track what gets lost. So a lot of the plays that I work with for my PhD, they all many of them got translated into different languages, and so it was very interesting for me to track like, oh, if you need to make this particular category cognizable to an audience in a different language, then what do you need to lose and what do you need to gain? Again, often that tends to be elision of things like caste and specificity of identities. Make it more general, more general.
Right, and tell our listeners a bit about Lavani.
Sure. So Lavani is both a part of tamasha. So it's kind of a genre of erotic dance, music, song. It is usually written by men, like it's poetry that's written by men, often sung and performed by women. And though it's not only always erotic, that's the primary kind. There are also lavanis that are about like education and going for like going to on a holiday and tourism and things like that. But lavani is primarily a dance and music form. What's interesting is that there are two main kinds of lavani. So one that is performed within tamashas, which is known as the dholki fad. Tamasha, which is one kind of lavni, sorry. And the second is lavnis that are performed individually by themselves. And there are specific kinds of social and cultural norms that surround these two kinds of lavnis. It's very much a form that you can still watch and enjoy. Films, they are really immortalized in films. It has a very specific beat. So if you know to recognize it, you can hear it and you can go tuck, 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 and the lavani is going to start. Increasingly now, over the last 3 years in India, lavani has been kind of repositioned as a queer art form. Like this is the new thing. Like if you have a queer pride event in India, there is a lavani show in it, one way or the other. So that has been its new kind of bastion as a queer form.
Yeah, I find that to be, I feel like that was always going to happen. I feel like it's such a platform that queers would gravitate towards.
And it's always been a phenomenally popular form. And now you have like there's a very popular platform for, I don't know how to describe it, the digital platform called Agents of Ishq, which is for like it's like a digital, what would you call it? Like a community space where you talk about love and relationships and all kinds of non-normative romantic liaisons. And they've done a couple of really interesting videos with Lavani dancers in collaboration with them to talk about consent and to talk about all these things that seem like kind of difficult topics. Like Lavani, which kind of really engages with eroticism in all its complexity, really lends itself to that kind of collaboration. You know, one of the things that got me really interested in this subject in the first place was this idea that if you want to make like if you want to do archival work with a performance, there's already a contradiction, right? Because a performance is live. So I can do it one night and I do it the other night and it's different. And so to me, it was really interesting that you're making like, you're kind of creating historical evidence, right? You're saying, I want to preserve this thing and I want to do it theatrically. So you get kind of both ends of the stick, right? On the one hand, you can do something that has permanence, but you're also not bound to it. You can do a different thing every night. And that was really interesting about theater as an archival form is that you can play it both ways. You can say I'm intervening historically, but also I'm changing what I say every day. And you can say, and you can deny what happened the previous night because there's no record of it, right? You can say like, I didn't say that. And so I was really interested in that fact that you can do that with performance. That obviously is very different now with when things are so much more through video and digital kind of things that have so much more permanence and traces in that way. So I think that's what's interesting about working in the arts. The present moment is also to clock how different it is from even not even that long ago, even 20 or 30 years later, where earlier, where you could really do things in this way where it was not recorded in the same way. Like all you had was scraps of a review or maybe an official video that someone took, or
Make mistakes.
but you could make mistakes, you could really change your tune, right? You could say, and now it's no longer possible, right? There's a way in which one is on guard, which is both a good thing. You should be able to call people out when they do nonsense and can get away with it. But then it also means that it changes the function of performance very specific in specific ways, especially live performance, right? It changes its impact and its kind of responsibility in a different way.
Does the lack of that impact how people are interacting with culture today? And does it impact how resistance is sort of done through art?
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe just our forms of resistance have changed. You know, there is, I think where one depended on kind of in the earlier modality, earlier times, you know, you would think of having to do something again and again and again and again to prove a point in the role of performance. I feel like now there is much more an emphasis on keeping like track of records, making proof. You know, I don't know if our levels of proof have changed. And honestly, I don't, this is something I'll have to think about, but I think that maybe the way that we think about evidence has changed and what does it mean? Though honestly, like look at, we have so much evidence. We have evidence of a genocide and nothing changes. Like you watch it every day. So it really makes you think of like, I think, okay, to go back, I think this kind of idea of I'm going to intervene through performance can only exist at a time when evidence has some kind of, it has prime importance, right? Where you live in a time where you can say, oh my God, I saw this thing and it changed my mind, or I saw proof and it changed something in me. I feel that the hopeless thing about our current situation is we have all the proof and it changes nothing, right? So then you feel helpless in such a way of like, we are trained to say if I furnish enough, good enough convincing evidence that something is wrong, things will change. Or if I can prove that this is unlawful, incorrect, immoral, something will change. This, the paradigm no longer works, right? So then the question is, what works? Like, how do we then figure out what's the right way to resist if the thing that we have inherited does not work anymore? I don't know.
It's a great question. Are you excited about the book? What's the plan for the book?
The plan for the book right now is TBD. I'm currently trying to figure out, I think I need to reframe it a little bit. It was very much a project that was very in the weeds, very specific, very granular in a way that a PhD can be, but a book cannot. So I'm currently trying to figure out how to make it slightly, give it some more air, some room to breathe. Address a slightly wider audience than the PhD had. And yeah, trying to figure out how to stay connected with this project that I feel like has been with me for so many years that it's feeling like a kind of 7-year itch situation. So how to get past the hump and keep going.
That was the start of a song from the 1959 Marathi film Sangte Aika, which focuses on the art of lavani and tamasha. We just heard from Sharvari about her upcoming book Performances of Posterity, Theatre, Archives and Cultural Regulation in Modern India, that looks into the arts of lavani and tamasha. Women on the Line is a national feminist current affairs program. It is produced and presented by a range of women and gender diverse broadcasters from 3CR in Nam, and broadcast across so-called Australia on the Community Radio Network with funding support from the Community Broadcast Foundation. The theme music for Women on the Line is by Ripley Kavara. All episodes can be downloaded from 3cr.org.au/womenontheline. I'm Kanagi. Tune in to Women on the Line next week on your community radio station.